Well, good morning. Glad to be here. And most importantly, not just to see one another, but to open up God's word and to be taught by it. So great to be with one another. And we resume our survey of the Old Testament this morning and looking forward to what we see next. So Frank's going to lead us in a prayer as we begin.
Our Father in heaven, we're thankful that you let us come together today to study your word and to worship you, and we pray that everything that we do and say will be in harmony with your will. Ask you to be with Brother Philip as he brings the word to us, that you would give him a good recall of the things that he studied and impart them to us in a way that we can understand and be better fruitful in your kingdom. Ask you to bless us through this day and watch over us that we before thee, in Jesus' name we pray.
Amen.
So we are surveying the divided kingdom period of the Old Testament, and this is what happens here, that Israel and Judah, made up Israel before, divide with Israel in the northern kingdom and Judah in the south, as well as Benjamin. The divided kingdom period, and maybe I may be injecting sort of my perspective or my emotions. I think we really are intrigued by the narrative of Genesis. We love the drama of Exodus and even the drama of the conquest. And then there is this, wow, things are wonderful, you know, under David and to some extent under Solomon. The divided kingdom is messy. It's complex. It's troublesome what's going on. But if you look at how much material is devoted to the divided kingdom, not just the narrative of 1 and 2 Kings and over in the Chronicles, but then the prophets. Most of the writing prophets are writing in the divided kingdom period. They're not writing during the heyday of David and Solomon. Most of them, it's in the divided kingdom, some during the captivity and then the exile, return, and so forth, as we'll see later on. And so there's a lot of material devoted to this time period in the Old Testament, which tells us something, that it's valuable. It may be more troublesome to read about, but it's very instructive. And that's what we're trying to do, is gain instruction from it. So when it comes to Judah, though, we saw last week, we surveyed Israel in the divided kingdom. We're going to come back to Israel and talk about the captivity. And we saw that Israel has about a 250-year history, but Judah continues after that, okay? And here's something else to do, and it's part of that constantly pulling back and looking at the big picture. And that is, after Israel falls, the northern kingdom, in 722, then the rest of the Old Testament, and even extending in the New Testament, the general focus is on Judah. Because Israel does not reconstitute after captivity and return. Judah does reconstitute and return. And then it's really Judah that exists in the New Testament, and Jews, see where that name comes from? Jews that are the focus in the New Testament, and though some of them are of the descendants of Benjamin and even some of the other Israelites, it really is the focus on this group of people, okay? The survivors of Judah. And we've already noticed how after the division that Benjamin sided with Judah. So Benjamin was located right in here. And we also know from certain texts that at least some of the priests, and there's indication that other faithful Israelites that lived in the north when things really went off the rails with Jeroboam, the first Israel king of Israel, they came down and lived in Judah. So Judah has sort of a little bit of a mixed population of various Hebrew people, but it's mostly people of the tribe of Judah. And watch how that the biblical record focuses on people of this particular lineage mostly, And that is those of the tribe of Judah. So let's look here at what's taking place with Judah during this divided kingdom period. And what I want to do is I want to look at some representative examples. We're going to look at three kings, three of the first kings of Judah. And you'll see that what's happening in their reign establishes a pattern, and you'll see characteristics that will be true of the Judean kings for years to come. You keep seeing these patterns, these characteristics over and over and over. So we're going to start with Rehoboam, who is the son of Solomon, who's, we've already seen, plays an important role in how the division came. He decided to be a king that put a lot of burdens on the people, like his father had, most likely because of the building projects. And so besides his hitting the throne hard and causing Israel to break away, which was all part of God's prophecy because of Solomon's disobedience, what happens to Rehoboam after this? What kind of king is he? Okay, so look what is stated here. Rick, will you read verses 21 to 28 of 1 Kings 14, please?
Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. And his mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy more than all that their fathers had done with the sins which they committed. For they also built for themselves high places and sacred pillars and Asherim on every high hill and beneath every luxuriant tree. And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. Now it came about in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and he took everything, even taking all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. So King Rehoboam made shields of bronze in their place and committed them to the care of the commanders of the guard who guarded the doorway of the king's home. King's house. Then it happened as often as the king entered the house of the Lord that the guards would carry them and would bring them back into the guard room.
All right, thank you. So, what was happening with the people? You know, in most of these texts about the king, the key initial note is this is the kind of king he was. He was either faithful to the Lord or he was, you know, disobedient to the Lord, and that's true of Israelite kings and the Judean kings. But here it starts off on the note of the people. Well, what's happening with the people? What does it say?
Basically doing everything the nations around them are doing at this point.
Right. And all centered around idolatry. Mm-hmm. Something associated with idolatry. By the way, who was Rehoboam's mother? She was an Ammonite. She was not of the Israelites. Remember Solomon's foreign wives? Which led him into what?
Idolatry.
See how you put all these pieces together? It appears that what Solomon begins to do, that it's trickling down to the people. Because you don't see this during the days of David. But by the time of the next king after Solomon, you're seeing this idolatry and things associated with it, even very putrid things associated with it, like male cult prostitutes. So Ken and I plan to make a video, I think it's maybe the next video we're going to make for the background of Israelite history on ancient religions. What are the main characteristics of ancient religions? And one of the characteristics that you see with ancient religions is that in a lot of the cult practices in worshiping this deity or that deity, oftentimes there was some kind of sexual immorality involved with it. No wonder it was popular. So it's appealing to the base appetites of people. And so that's trickling in already into Judah. So, see that happening here. See that there is already an internal moral decay taking place in Judah that's going on here among the people. And what of the next shift here in analyzing Rehoboam's reign is what's happening with foreign powers? And in particular, what foreign power is mentioned?
Egypt.
Don't forget Egypt. Don't think that when the Israelites left Egypt, that everything was in ashes and it never recovered. Egypt does recover, and Egypt stays a world power, you could say, and definitely a regional power for a long, 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 long time. So in most of the Old Testament, Egypt is still a contender for power in the Middle East. And what does Egypt do to Judah in this text that Rick just read? And they come up against Judah and they fleece, you know, the temple of the gold or the Jerusalem of some of the gold and some of the accoutrements here. And so this was a very heavy-handed move. Yeah, Andrew?
Either Ecclesiastes or Proverbs, Rehoboam lost all his dad's money to Egypt.
Yeah, he did. I got a sermon and a sermon notes. I've never preached it. It's in a folder and I run into it every now and then of sermon ideas. And what happened to the gold? One day I'm going to preach a sermon. What happened to the gold? All that gold that Solomon acquired? You have all this text emphasizing the gold. What happened to that gold? Well, here's part of the answer. Foreign powers got it. So there you go. So I may preach it one day. Or Andrew, you can preach it. There you go. You seem to be on that. So, but, you know, look what's happening to Judah. They're weakening. Foreign powers are really threatening them. Remember how that David extended their rule and set garrisons up and they had a buffer zone all around Israel? No more. They're vulnerable. Even Judah is up in the hill country. So watch how that these various foreign threats will continue to plague Judah. Sometimes Israel is a little more secure, but that's what you're seeing there. Let's look at the next king, his son, Abijam. 1 Kings chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. 1 Kings 15, 1 through 8. Earl, can you read that for us, please?
Now in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijam became king of Judah. He reigned 3 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Micaiah, the daughter of Abishalom. And he walked in all the sins of his father, which he had committed before him, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, like the heart of his father David. But for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem to raise up his son after him and to establish Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the sight of the Lord and had not turned aside from anything that he had commanded him all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite. And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. Now the rest of the acts of Abijam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And there was war between Abijam and Jeroboam. Did you say through 7 or 8?
8, yeah.
And Abijam slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa, his son, became king in his place.
All right, thank you. According to verse 3, what is the initial assessment of Abijam?
Walking in the sins of his father.
He walked in the sins of his fathers. Okay, this is interesting. Now, typically, when you read that kind of statement in the divided kingdom, it's a reference to idolatry. Okay, what's the deal here? There is nothing directly said, either in Kings or Chronicles, about Rehoboam committing acts of idolatry. We are told in 2 Chronicles 12 that he abandoned the law of the Lord. And you can see that's not going to be very far off, idolatry, if you do that. But there's no direct connection to Rehoboam and idolatry. But it could be implied in that statement, as well as this statement here that Abijam is walking in the sins of his father. Okay. However, what father of Abijam for sure committed adultery?
Jeroboam.
I'm sorry, adultery, idolatry. Which father, quote, father or ancestor had committed idolatry? Solomon, his grandfather. So that might be the reference there. I don't know if it skipped a generation from Rehoboam to Abijah. I'm sorry, from Solomon to Abijah, but not far-fetched to conclude that Rehoboam was involved in it too. Now, the sins of the father continues to plague, okay, Judah, what Solomon started. Now, however, there's another ancestor that is affecting what's going on still. Specifically, what does the text say continue to affect how God dealt with Judah? David. David's legacy continued to affect God's dealings with Judah. Several times in the text, it's David's faithfulness that continued to prolong judgment on Judah and continued to affect God in being very long-suffering with Judah. And I think there's a lot to stew on there. We understand, and you see it vividly demonstrated in the divided kingdom, that in Ezekiel makes the point, and he comes along at the end of the divided kingdom, that the son doesn't bear the sins of the father, that you're responsible for your own behavior. While that is true, it is also true that what you do can affect people for a long time to come. And you see it here in the example of David in a positive way. So look at the next king, his son, Asa. 1 Kings chapter 15. Zachary, can you read verse 9 to 17? 1 Kings 15, 9 to 17.
So in the 20th year of Jeroboam, the king of Israel, Asa began to reign as king of Judah. He reigned 41 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Maachah, the daughter of Ishmael. Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like David his father. He also put away the male cult prostitutes from the land, and removed all the idols which his fathers had made. He also removed Maachah, his mother, from being queen mother, because she had made a horrid image as an Asherah. And Asa cut down her horrid image and burned it at the brook Kidron. But the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly devoted to the Lord all his days. He brought into the house of the Lord the dedicated things of his father, silver and golden utensils. Now there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and fortified Ramah in order to prevent anyone from going out or coming into Asa, king of Judah.
All right, thank you. All right, how is Asa different?
Well, he's going to walk in the way of David, his father's, in the right place.
And in order to do that, what must he do?
Purge.
He's a reformer. That term is a very generic term. It has social application, political application, economic application. Here we're talking about the reformer kings, or those who take the throne and they realize we're not serving the Lord. We're not keeping covenant with our God. And they have to purge, it's a good word, the idolatry and the things associated with idolatry from the land. And watch how, to what extent they do that. Sometimes they're very extensive in how they do this. Sometimes they're not as extensive, either by their efforts or what they're able to do with the people. Sometimes they're able to steer the people away from these idolatrous practices. Sometimes, in spite of their efforts, the people are clinging to some of the idolatrous ways. And in his reform, he even, real practical insight here, he had to go as far as to do what? To try to clean up Judah.
Remove his mother from being clean.
He had to eliminate his own mother's influence who had been involved in this. Remember what Jesus said about a sword?
Two-edged.
Yeah, he did. Well, it is two-edged. He said he came to bring a sword, and specifically in that context, he's talking about family members. They're either going to choose to follow him or not. And so Asa has to stand against his mother in this. Rick, what do you want?
Even his father. And of course his father.
Yeah. Yeah, so you want, where does that influence come from? You know, he's got both parents who are idolaters. You know, what happened in his life that caused him to go that direction?
You know, certainly we understand that Genesis is rich material about family relationships, mostly for what not to do. The divided kingdom is also a fascinating set of material about family relationships. And one of the things you see demonstrated here with Asa is, we just said a while ago that you can have a lot of influence in the generations ahead of you. The other lesson that we see here is, my parents don't define me.
I just pointed out one thing I hadn't heard about before, is that Asa's mother is also his grandmother.
Yeah, I was hoping nobody would bring this up. And I'd have to explain this, so. Y'all can see Catherine for that later. It's, yeah, complicated, so I don't have time for that. So. Becca, moving right ahead.
I was going to say the same thing. Because mine actually says it's his grandmother.
Y'all are just getting too thorough in your search description. Andrew?
The Chronicles indicates that when Egypt showed up, Rehoboam reformed.
Rehoboam what?
Reformed himself. He humbled himself.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Rehoboam has some qualities where he humbles himself, yeah.
Asa's father was only king for 3 years, so Asa could have seen that. It's interesting,
right,
across the Chronicles, right, of the kings of Judah, that even kings that reformed, like Manasseh, who had a total 180% change, they are still listed as evil or good based on what they did earlier.
Yeah, that's true. And you're right. I mean, there are a couple instances, like Rehoboam went to carry out a war against Israel, and God told him not to, and he obeyed God on that. So he had some redeeming qualities at times, Rehoboam did. Yeah, he did. So what reformers have to do, they have to do two things. They have to remove idolatrous practices, and of course, there's a vacuum there. And they have to restore covenant worship, covenant of Moses. Because usually what has happened is that's been marginalized. So understand, I think we talked about this earlier, the idea of syncretic religion. The Israelites, north and south, didn't just completely toss out Jehovah and Jehovah worship. What they did was they added to Jehovah worship idolatrous practices. They were covering all their bases. We'll worship Jehovah, we'll worship Baal, we'll worship Asheroth, we'll worship all, El, worship all these different gods. Make sure our bases are covered. But what happens in that is Jehovah worship becomes marginalized. And so the reformer has to come in, he has to purge the idolatry, but he has to bring back in strong fashion the covenant worship. And so again, some are more successful at that than others. And what's the other characteristic? It's actually mentioned back with Abijam, but there's even more said about it here about Asa. What continual conflict is there with for Judah? What? Well, that, yeah, the idolatry thing. With whom do they have, bad question, with whom does Judah continue to have conflict? Israel. Right. Sorry. Bad question. Good answer. Question was bad. Yeah. Do what? Listen to your question. Well, we're both. But this is mentioned with Abijam that there was conflict, but there's a lot here said in Asa's reign. So there is continual conflict with Israel. They're still fighting with their brothers, their relatives, I guess you could say. Now, that is very characteristic of the kings of Judah. When you look at those first three kings of Judah, those are the patterns, those are the characteristics. There are some exceptions. There are some really unusual things that happen, like a female descendant of Ahab's house ends up temporarily ruling Judah, okay, Athaliah, but we're not going to get into that, okay? So, but that's typically what happens. I want us to go forward, and I want us to look at the extremes. And these really are some illustrations of what we were talking about earlier regarding generations. So I want you to go with me over to 2 Kings. We're going to leap ahead in time toward the latter part of Judah's kingdom in the divided kingdom period. 2 Kings chapter 18, we're going to come to a king called Hezekiah. 2 Kings 16, my bad. 2 Kings 16. Let's see here. It's 18. I have it wrong on the screen. I have it right in my notes. 2 Kings 18, please. 2 Kings 18. Daryl, can you read verses 1 to 4? 2 Kings 18, 1 through 4, first of all.
Now it came about in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm wrong and right, okay? I flipped my pages ahead of time. We're going to start with Ahaz, who is the father of Hezekiah. So sorry. 2 Kings 16.
1 through 4.
1 through 4. It says it here and it says it there. I'm about as sure as I can be. I just flipped my notes too early. I went to Hezekiah. I love Hezekiah so much. But I want you to watch this. This is something else I should have said. The guy who put this together knew what he was doing, but this guy. Watch this. The three kings we're going to look at are father, son, and grandson. Father, son, and grandson. I mean, we all understand that there are periods when father, son, and grandson are all living at the same time. Okay? And understand you don't become king until the father dies, so we get that. But look how that this is sort of bracketed together here. Now, Daryl's going to read to us about Ahaz, 2 Kings 16, 1 to 4.
In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, became king. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, and even made his son pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had driven out from before the sons of Israel. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree.
Okay, how is Ahaz assessed in a generic fashion here? What's he like? Very idolatrous. He's of Judah. You got to watch this. You might think he's a king of Israel, but he's not. He's a Davidic lineage king. And note this statement here in verse 4, sacrifice and made offerings on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Ahaz, I guess, could make the case, hey, I'm more religious than anybody. I'm worshiping everywhere. Depending on how you define that, right? You know? I believe this, and I worship this way, and I embrace this practice, and I embrace this kind of worship. And somebody can say, see how religious I am? You can be very religious and be wrong. How terrible was it during Ahaz's day?
Human sacrifice.
Child sacrifice. He made a son pass through the fire, which is an expression for child sacrifice, which we saw some time ago. Actually, we saw in the video Ken I made, we talked about this. People of Canaan practice child sacrifice. So look what's happening. It doesn't deserve a whole lot of commentary to show how low this got, okay, how bad it was. And then now flip down with me, Daryl, read verse 10 to 14. He becomes buddy-buddy with Syria. At this point in the middle to latter part of the divided kingdom, Syria, not Assyria, but Syria is a major regional power that is influencing both Israel and Judah. And Ahaz becomes an ally to Syria. And look what happens, 10 to 14.
Now King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he saw the altar which was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the pattern of the altar and its model according to all its workmanship. So Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. Thus Urijah the priest made it before the coming of King Ahaz from Damascus. And when the king came from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached the altar and went up to it, and burned his offering and his meal offering, and poured his libation and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. And the bronze altar, which was before the Lord, he brought from the front of the house, from between his altar and the house of the Lord, and he put it on the north side of his altar.
Ahaz goes to Damascus of Syria, which is a significant power at this time. So this is some place to visit. You know, like first time you ever go to Atlanta, or the first time you ever go to New York or Chicago or somewhere like that, right? So he goes to Damascus. What happens to him? What does he do? What does he see?
Well, he sees the altar and goes up and sacrifices.
He sees, evidently, it's some kind of unique or fancy altar that he sees that they have in Syria in their pagan worship. And he decides to do what? Copy it and put one at the front of the temple. And he takes the altar that was, you know, designed by the law of Moses back in the book of Exodus. And what happens to that altar? They've been putting, you know, sacrifices on that kind of altar. What happens to that altar? They move it to another side of the temple. See, that idea of, okay, we're going to inject pagan worship and we're going to slide some of the Jehovah worship to another location. Again, it becomes marginalized. And he begins to offer up his sacrifices on this altar. You see, he found something better than what God had come up with. Isn't that incredible how humans will do that? We come up with things better than what God makes.
But it's amazing how religious this king is.
And he's still very religious. He makes sacrifices to God with this. Okay?
Isn't it weird that he goes up to Damascus because the king of Assyria wipes out Damascus and takes him out? Yet he copies the altar of the people of Damascus.
Yeah, I mean, they're wiped out late. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, but Damascus, Tiglath-Pileser is an Assyrian king. But Damascus is, because Syria had been so powerful, Damascus is a showcase city. Okay, yeah, it is a king of Assyria that he meets. Okay, because Assyria, here's what's happening. Syria is doing this, Assyria is doing this. Okay? Right.
And went up against Damascus and took its people.
Right.
And Ahaz went to meet him in Damascus.
Right.
So why is he copying the gods and people that just got defeated?
Right.
It just seems odd.
But Damascus had been a major city for a long time. Many, many years. It's on the decline, okay? It's like London. London doesn't have the glory that it did in 1870. But people still love to go to London and look at things. London is not the city that, say, Beijing is today. Beijing has more world influence in a way than London. 150 years ago, London. But people still glory in London, okay? Damascus was a showcase city because it was a city part of an empire that had been very strong for a while, regional power. They're sliding under Assyria now. But he goes there and he's like, I like that altar. I want that altar for our temple. And so he's corrupting even further Israelite worship. And look what he's motivating. You got John?
You've already basically said what I was going to say. Nothing changes. It's so easy for people to be influenced. It goes on today. This is a better way to worship. This is a nicer way to get more people. It's continuous.
You know, he had to think this is a better version of an altar than the one we have. That's how he's thinking. But he's not thinking, well, what did God want? What did God tell us? Right. Right. It's the same mentality. Directly. So look at the next king, Hezekiah, the man I've been wanting to talk about. Second Kings chapter 18. 2 Kings 18. Ken, can you read for us verses 1 to 8 about Hezekiah's introduction?
In the third year of Hosea, the son of Elam, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that David, his father, had done. He removed the high places and broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings to it. It was called Nebushtan. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but he kept the commandments of the Lord commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him whenever he went out. He prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from the watchtower to the fortified city.
All right, thank you. What kind of king is this? Have a lot of specific things that he does, but initially he's depicted in the most complimentary way possible. What does it say about him in verse 3?
He did what was right in the sight of the Lord.
And what was the benchmark? According to the way David walked. Again, you know what statements like that are telling us? They're not so much elevating David. Because a while ago, we saw a reference to the Uriah incident. That's always on his record. I mean, it's on the historical record. Really, what statements like that, they're as much about looking forward as they are looking backward. They're messianic. Because what's being drilled into the reader's thinking is that David is the standard. David is the standard. But of course, David's got issues. But then the son of David comes along who does not have the flaws of his ancestor David. He is the truly complete king. So we're being, as readers of the Bible, we're being trained to think in terms of David is the standard. And then the son of David is going to come. The standard is going to come. So Hezekiah is a wonderful king. Look at all that he's doing here. But remember, whose son was he? Ahaz. And it's actually by God's grace, isn't it, and protection that Hezekiah is even alive. Why?
Because Ahaz was offering his kids.
He practiced child sacrifice. It says his son, singular, so maybe he just did it one time. But Hezekiah is blessed to be alive. His father was a child sacrificer. And here he is. And not only that, look how young he is when he becomes king. He's pretty young. Well, what matters is he's following the way of the Lord. Okay? He is a reformer. And look at all the actions. All the actions. And by the way, look at this. When you're a reformer, it's a messy job. He's not just building things. He's having to bust up things. You see that? He's having to break some furniture to make room for true worship. But it's verse 5 that tells us his reason for doing this. He's not motivated to be a certain kind of king of Judah. What's really driving Hezekiah, according to verse 5?
Trust in the Lord.
Trust in the Lord. It's his relationship with the Lord that's driving him to be this. And this is a characteristic. I think it's worth noting. I think we have to be careful with it. And that is, in Judah, the kings that were most faithful to the Lord were the kings that brought more security and more prosperity to Judah. And don't misinterpret that. That doesn't mean, if we can just get a governor of North Carolina who's a Christian, then all of us will be wealthy. That's not how it works. God has a special relationship with Judah here. Just like he had with all of Israel before. And he said, I'm going to bless you in this land if you follow me. If not, your crops are not going to be abundant and your enemies are going to attack you. That's a unique kind of thing. God doesn't work that way anymore. God's working in a spiritual kingdom now. But the principle is Hezekiah brought good days to Judah. That was the arrangement God had made with these people. If you'll follow me, I'll bless you. Even in a physical way. And Hezekiah is a really great ruler in a lot of ways. Okay? So, and here's another big thing about it. It says, at the last part that he read there, verse 7, who did he stand up to?
King of Syria.
Syria. So it's a while ago, this is the time of the divided kingdom, when Assyria is rising, and Assyria, during the days of Hezekiah, invades and topples Israel. And Assyria threatens Judah. And there's a lot made in the First Kings, Second Kings text, in the Chronicles text, and in the book of Isaiah. Three times in the Old Testament, we have the story of Hezekiah trusting in God and Jerusalem being delivered from the Assyrian onslaught. And so this is a man, and by the way, Isaiah is a prophet at this time, and he listens to Isaiah, unlike a lot of kings who don't listen to the prophets. And so he's a heroic king for the people of Judah. And in a very dark hour, he stands Churchillian, I guess, and he digs in and trusts God, and the Assyrians are held at bay, and they go back, they're defeated. And so this is a wonderful leader here. And then he has a son. 2 Kings 21, 1 through 7. Tristan, can you read that for us? 2 Kings 21, 1 through 7, please.
Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places that Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he erected altars for Baal, and made an Asherah, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served them. And he built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, In Jerusalem will I put my name. And he built altars for the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. And he burned his son as an offering, and used fortune-telling and omens, and dealt with mediums and necromancers. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And the carved image of Asherah that he made, he set in the house which the Lord said to David and to Solomon his son, In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. See which one?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you. So, the son of Hezekiah, this godly, spiritual man who trusted the Lord and worked hard to follow the way of the Lord. It's like the recorder here, the writer here, just after he lists so many things, he's worshiping every kind of God imaginable. He's making great effort to worship them by building great things to worship them. He puts things in and around the temple to worship these false gods. He corrupts even the inside of the temple, okay? He burns his son in the fire. He's tapping into, instead of listening to the prophets, he's going to fortune tellers and all these people who claim to have some kind of, you know, supernatural ability to give you guidance and tell you the future. He's leaning on them instead of listening to the prophets of God. And it just gets to the point where at the end of verse 6, he did much evil. He just, you know, what more can you say? He's just as evil as they become, as they can be. And what you see here, what trend you see here is a downward spiral. That's what's happening now in Judah. And what you're seeing here in the days of Manasseh is full-blown pagan idolatry. Full-blown. All the way. And we know over in Chronicles' record that he fills the streets with blood. He's very oppressive and is very, you know, even murderous, evidently, on the people. All these things are happening. Full-blown idolatry. Okay? And there will be, and we can talk about this later, there's going to be another really faithful king, Josiah. But what we see in this text here, according to verses 10 to 15, is that Judah has now passed the point of no return. In spite of Josiah's reforms, Judah's downfall is inevitable. It's coming. Okay, thank you.